Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the cancellation of the European Summit of Leaders from all 28 states due to the continuing impasse in the negotiations over debt relief between Greece and the Eurozone finance ministers. Mark Blyth, a professor of international political economy at Brown University and author of Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea, joins us to discuss the excruciating pressure being exacted upon the Greek people in the name of austerity, even though it is the German and French banks who were bailed out, not the Greek people, who saw very little of the 320 billion euros lent to Greece. Then we'll look into the scathing Hoffman report, which exposes collusion between the American Psychological Association and senior CIA and Pentagon officials to protect the Bush-Cheney torture regime and silence the criticism from health professionals within the CIA who opposed the agency's post-9/11 enhanced interrogation program. Dr. Stephen Saltz, a clinical psychologist and director of the Center for Research, Evaluation and Program Development at the Boston School of Psychoanalysts and co-founder of the Coalition for an Ethical Psychology, joins us. He was one of two dissident psychologists inside the American Psychological Association who objected to the collaboration. Then finally, we'll go to Mexico City to speak with a Wall Street Journal correspondent who has covered Mexico for 27 years. Dudley Althaus joins us to discuss the political embarrassment Mexico's president and his entourage of 400 are feeling during their state visit to France following the second brazen escape of the drug lord El Chapo Guzman from a maximum security prison, this time via a mile-long tunnel dug from a construction site to the private shower inside Guzman's cell. And joining us now is Mark Blyth, Professor of Political Economy and Faculty Fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University. He's the author of Great Transformations, Economic Ideas and Institutional Change in the 20th Century, and his latest book is Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Blyth.
Hello, Lillian. Can you hear me? I'm not sure the signals are great on this one.
Okay. Well, you're in a car, are you?
Yes, unfortunately.
Okay, well, let's go while the going's good. So, what do you make of the cancellation of the European Summit of Leaders of the 28 Euro nations? And now, apparently, it's all in the hands of the finance ministers, who are having a difficult time, an extremely difficult time, according to Angela Merkel, in making a deal.
Well, there's a couple of things going on. Until you actually get a deal done to the finance ministers, you can't get to the whole head of the summit's agreement. And you've got Schäuble now with the German finance ministry essentially trying to do a Grexit for 5 years, where they've become basically some kind of protectorate of the EU, pledge a bunch of assets for privatization if they don't follow through on the program. Now, the really disappointing thing in all of this is it ignores the fact that the Greek economy is already in dire straits, and they're simply piling on more of the same medicine and hoping that you get a different result.
Well, the point I made in the opening is that the German and Greek and French banks are the ones that were bailed out by the $320 billion, a billion euros. The Greek people have seen very little of this money, so Merkel has not told the German people that this is what it's about, isn't it? I mean, they keep blaming the Greek people. They haven't seen anything of the bailout. The bailout went to the banks.
Oh, yeah, the most majority of it did, but that was back in 2010 and 2012. Since then, the economy shrunk further and further, and the same medicine has been applied. Another round of budget cuts, another set of fiscal targets, which will be extremely difficult for a very old, relatively unproductive population to fulfill in the best of times, let alone the worst of times. So admitting to the bank bailouts is, you know, that's very important as to how we got here, but it has very little to do with how we get out of it at this point in time.
So these, so far we've the leaks in terms of these negotiations say that there'll be a tax rise on shipping companies, a VAT rate raised to 23%, which includes restaurants and catering, phasing out solidarity grants for pensioners by 2019, cut of 300 million euros in defense spending, privatization of ports, and a sell-off of remaining shares in telecoms. and scrapping a 30% tax break for the wealthiest islands. This feels like squeezing blood out of a stone. What is anybody talking about how to stimulate the Greek economy to bring about growth and bring about revenues?
No, not at all. In fact, the real tragedy here is the people who are saying that actually believe that those measures will bring about growth and bring about a return to the Greek economy, which, of course, is part of the problem rather than part of the solution. So it seems that the Eurogroup and the finance ministers are still singing from the same austerity script, regardless of the discordant chorus coming from Greece. We also have today that the ship owners, and admittedly the ship owners don't pay any tax, but they probably should pay more tax, but they say if you tax us, we're leaving. So we've got advanced warning now that the economy is going to shrink for yet another reason. So the entire policy package is to stay counterproductive at best and hopeless at least.
So where in history, since you wrote a book about austerity, the history of a dangerous idea, it's extraordinary that it lives on in the face of absolutely overwhelming evidence that it's never worked, as far as I can tell. Has it ever worked? I mean, I guess it works for the bankers.
Well, there's been situations where it looks like it's worked, but it's confusing causation and correlation. So one of the cases that people are most familiar with is Canada. So Canada likes to say that in the 1980s and 1990s, it cut its budget deficit, it got its spending over control, and it grew. Well, what also happened at that point in Canada was a 40% devaluation of the currency at the same time as the American economy, which takes 80% of its exports and is 8 times the size, went on a tear. So you've got basically a devaluation effect and a huge export boost at exactly the time when they happen to be cutting spending. Well, that's too confusing correlation and causation, because ultimately you're going to get more tax receipts in the door because the Canadian economy is expanding because of a devaluation effect. So even in the cases where it supposedly has worked, if you bother to look into the details, you find out that it really hasn't. At least not for the reasons which are said. In the Eurozone just now, we've got a similar story. Look, Spain is growing. Well, Spain is growing because France is running a budget deficit. Oh, well, Ireland did well. Ireland is the size of Brooklyn, New York. And basically, they did this by booking Apple and Google profits with corporation tax 12.5% and calling it a services export. So basically, it's about the integrity of the narrative, because the creditors want their money back rather than the macroeconomic efficiency.
So what happened to Keynesianism? I mean, that's proven to be the way that you get out of economic difficulties, either a recession or a depression. And we know that that there was an attempt of some Keynesianism under Obama to stimulate the economy. It wasn't enough. That was sabotaged and whittled down. And it's clearly made the recovery longer and more painful. I just can't believe that the evidence is not understood. And also, by the way, it seems criminal that at a time when there was massive unemployment, and there still is a lot of unemployment, when interest rates are so low and money is so cheap, that the U.S. didn't invest in its crumbling infrastructure. And still the question remains, why not? Because that would employ an enormous lot of people. But you just get the feeling that there's a sort of world, two separate universes here, the world of the banking elites and their political lackeys, and the world of ordinary people and what they need. And the former wins out.
Yeah, but I mean, even then, it's more than just the banking elite and the lackeys. I mean, if you think about what the bank bailouts and recapitalizations and the stimulus and everything was, basically, when you bail out the banks, you bail out the assets of the banks. The assets of the banks are everybody else's liabilities and vice versa. So if you have a mortgage, if you have a pension, you don't need to be a member of the banking elite. But if they actually let the banks fail, then your 401k would have went bust if you have one. Your mortgage would have went into some kind of legal limbo because nobody would have known who owned it or what its real rate of value was. So you're bailing out large sections of the middle and upper middle class at the same time. So that's the reason why this sticks around, because this actually does benefit some people, not just the tiny little banking elite. Basically, the top 20% of the country that has most of the assets. And they basically use the bottom 80% as an insurance policy. Now, in Europe, the problem's compounded. How do you do Keynesianism when you don't have your own printing press? Because if you've already got 100% debt to GDP and your yields have gone through the roof, if you try and sell more debt, you can sell it, but you'll sell it at a rate that will bankrupt you. So the institutional design of the euro made it such that it was almost impossible to do what they needed to do.
So in other words, the fact that we have a Fed saved us, and the fact that the European Central Bank is simply not up to the task and isn't designed to be up to the task, that's made the difference.
Exactly. If they had had the Fed back in 2010, they would be having the same arguments we have about who benefited and why did the bankers not go to jail, but they'd be looking at 5.5% unemployment and 2.5% growth, instead of which we're celebrating Spain and they have 20% unemployed in the adult population and 50% youth population, and they're calling it a recovery.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Blyth, who's a professor of political economy and faculty fellow at the Watson Institute for International Public Affairs at Brown University. He's the author of Great Transformations, Economic Ideas and Institutional Change in the 20th Century. And his latest book is Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea. But when I see pictures of Greek citizens weeping beside empty ATMs, and then you see also pictures of the growing number of soup kitchens and stuff, you wonder. I mean, for example, I come from Australia, and after World War One, when the Australians contributed more deaths per capita than any other country in that war, they in total they lost more men than the United States did in World War One. Tremendous sacrifices. They returned home from the war, and the British government then hit them with a war debt. So not only did they pay in blood, then they had to pay in treasure, and they sent out a banker from the City of London to advise the Australian government, led by one of those pathetic Anglophiles who wanted to be a part of the British aristocracy. And from between the two wars, they absolutely devastated Australia's population with poverty, both in the country and both rural and urban poverty, in a country that's amazingly wealthy in natural resources and tremendous amount of production of food. People were going hungry. So that's the part of it that I don't understand, is why, you believe in an abstraction at the expense of the visible human cost.
Well, the visible human cost is largely invisible to those people who are pushing the policies. And that's the tragedy of the whole thing. So, you know, you've had, it's something along the lines of a 70-fold increase in HIV infection, a collapse in public health, shutting down hospitals, all this like terrible stuff going on in Greece. And essentially, let's take even more money from pensioners seems to be the response. So, you know, to take the Australian example you just talked about, the reason that the Brits did that is because the Brits were broke. They were completely bust after World War One, and they saw Australia as an asset. So they basically wanted the debt back. It's no different from the credit and debt standoff we have in Europe today.
Well, that's why I brought it up. In the Greek case, then, do you think that that this will go the way of the Germans? Apparently, there is a split between France and Germany. The French are more reasonable in terms of wanting to make a deal with Greece, and the Germans aren't. Is this posturing, or do you think that they really want to go to the mat and even push Greece into an exit, even if it's temporary, as some of the leaks from Germany indicate?
Well, Yanis Varoufakis had a very interesting piece in The Guardian yesterday, so I'm just going to quote from him. This is basically about scaring the French to death. And the Greeks are going to be used as an example by Schäuble and the Germans to make sure that any notion of redistribution or reflation is knocked out of the European Union once and for all, and the debtors will pay their debts to the full. Now, that's why I've said this to me 6 months ago. I would say, no, that's just ideological thinking. But in actual fact, I've got no evidence to counterbalance on the other side. Now, I think Yanis is completely correct on this. Ultimately, what Syriza represented was a threat to the European project, and that threat will be dealt with ruthlessly. So you can sign whatever agreement you want with the Greeks tomorrow. You're expecting them to run in a devastated economy, a 3.5% budget surplus for the next 30 years, and then hand over 4% of GDP every year to a bunch of foreigners rather than invest it in your own country. That's called the Versailles Treaty. It didn't work out very
Well, just in closing then, if Greece does exit and there's total chaos, and would that bring in the geostrategy community, the United States, NATO and others that would be afraid that Greece may leave NATO and make some kind of deal with Putin?
Well, I was talking to someone this morning about this, and her opinion was that, you know, perhaps the Greeks have already done the Bacchanal feeling for the United States to say, you really need to help us out here because we're a NATO member and we're being defenestrated by other NATO members, so we really need help. So ultimately, the United States are already there, we just don't know it yet. We'll find out soon.
Well, Mark Blythe, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Mark Blythe, who's a professor of political economy and a faculty fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University. He's the author of Great Transformations, Economic Ideas and Institutional Change in the 20th Century. And his latest book is Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the American Psychological Association's collaboration with the Bush-Cheney torture regime. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Stephen Saltz, who is an anti-torture advisor with Physicians for Human Rights, who is the director of the Center for Research, Evaluation, and Program Development at the Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis and co-founder of the Coalition for an Ethical Psychology. He's one of the two dissident psychologists inside the American Psychological Association who opposed their collaboration with the Bush-Cheney torture regime, which has just been exposed in the scathing Hoffman Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Stephen Saltz.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And before we get into talking about Physicians for Human Rights asking the Department of Justice to investigate the American Psychological Association's collusion with the CIA and Pentagon torturers, you have been sort of a thorn on the inside, if you will, at the APA, and your report to them, All the President's Psychologists, the American Psychological Association's secret complicity with the White House and U.S. intelligence community in support of CIA's enhanced interrogation program, that came out prior to this just-released Hoffman Report, did it not?
Yes, it did. It came out on April 30th in the online in the New York Times.
So, what was what propelled them? I mean, first of all, who commissioned the Hoffman Report after your report? It was ongoing, right, when your report came out?
Yeah. Well, this issue has been an active one in the APA since 2005, when they adopted a policy that it was ethical for psychologists to participate in national security interrogations. There was, from then on, there's been massive opposition in the profession and among others, including human rights groups around the world. So last October, James Risen of the New York Times published his latest book, Pay Any Price. And one of the chapters in there reports on emails between a deceased CIA contractor, Scott Derware, and APA, CIA, and White House officials that showed collaboration between the groups. And so he reported on those emails fairly briefly in there. The APA first denounced him and said it was ridiculous, but but then they backpedaled and said, well, it's ridiculous, but we need to investigate. And they hired David Hoffman of Chicago to conduct an independent investigation. James Rising gave us those emails for further analysis, and all the president's psychologists was the result of many months of analysis by a small group of us, is providing further details on APA-CIA collaboration. We also gave those emails to Mr. Hoffman. We spent many hours with him, giving him documents, information, et cetera. But he understood what we believe to be the case there, and he looked further with additional evidence.
And as a result of the Hoffman report being made public on Friday, the American Psychological Association issued an apology saying the actions, policies, and lack of independence from government influence described in the Hoffman report represented a failure to live up to our core values. We profoundly regret and apologize for the behavior and the consequences that ensued. Is there an analogy here in terms of certainly, psychiatrists are also MDs. So they have signed off on the Hippocratic Oath, which says first do no harm. And in terms of executions in this country, there's been a lot of botched and somewhat barbaric executions using these drug protocols that they have. And part of it is that no doctor who's signed on the Hippocratic Oath will participate in executing people, because that is clearly the antithesis of the Hippocratic Oath of first do no harm. So did they have a hard time finding people in terms of the medical profession to engage in torture? Is there an analogy there between executions and torture in terms of medical professionals being barred from engaging in it?
Well, first, the analogy, I think, goes deeper, because while the American Medical Association took a position against the physician involvement in death penalty, they didn't. It is not a bar. They have never enforced it against any physician who does, and there are always doctors present. So similarly, in psychology, there were psychologists involved. The CIA Enhanced Interrogation Program was created and implemented by these two psychologists, and psychologists have been present at Guantanamo on so-called behavioral science consultation teams, where they consult to interrogations. That has been true since almost the beginning. So there's never a difficulty in getting a small number of people to do what you want, unfortunately.
Well, but it does seem that they scraped the bottom of the barrel. I mean, Mitchell and Jessen, the two psychologists who were hired by the CIA under contract, and I believe their contract was something like $125 million. They just recycled an old Air Force Korean War training manual to prepare pilots who might be shot down over North Korea who would be subjected to brainwashing. And of course, in the case of the North Koreans, they weren't interested in extracting secrets. They wanted to get false confessions. So the whole thing just was absurd on the surface, wasn't it?
I agree. And one of the silly parts of it is that when the Bush administration and the CIA decided to launch this, what we hear is they didn't consult with any veteran interrogators. I mean, the military, the FBI have many interrogators who know how to talk to people. They didn't talk to any of them. They talked to these two psychologists whose main contribution, in addition to just being there at the right time and being cocky enough to say we'll do this, was to give a patina of science to this. So it was based on the so-called scientific theory of learned helplessness built by University of Pennsylvania psychologist Martin Seligman, and former APA president. But you're right. It was basically the same techniques from the Cold War that many torturing regimes have used, the Chicago Police Department. But it had this patina of science. It's based on the theory of learned helplessness. That's the only thing that was really new there.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Stephen Saltz, who's an anti-torture advisor with Physicians for Human Rights, who is the director of the Center for Research, Evaluation and Program Development at the Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis and co-founder of the Coalition for an Ethical Psychology. He is one of the two dissident psychologists inside the American Psychological Association who opposed their collaboration with the Bush-Cheney torture regime, which has just been exposed in the scathing Hoffman Report. And it does seem that the...
There are many psychologists who oppose this. We're just two of many.
Right. But at least you were able to address the board, were you not? I mean, how many...
Yes.
And can we name names? I mean, James Risen has named some names. Is there a chance that some of these people will will there be, I guess with the Congress being the way it is, we're not going to have a congressional hearing, but Physicians for Human Rights have asked the Department of Justice to investigate the American Psychological Association's collusion with the CIA and Pentagon torturers. Do you expect at some point or other any of these people who've been named to actually have to testify somewhere and at least be exposed to the court of public opinion?
I would hope so. I haven't given up on congressional investigation. It seems unlikely at the moment. Senator McCain has issued a tweet saying that he's disturbed by this. And Senator Feinstein similarly expressed her being disturbed by our April report. So there is interest in Congress. And we very much want a congressional investigation because Mr. Hoffman only had access to APA materials. He didn't have access to the intelligence agency, and in particular to classified material. We need an investigation that can fill in the other side. What was going on in the intelligence agencies and the Defense Department and the CIA, and only some type of federal investigation with security clearance and subpoena power can do that.
But my understanding is that the reason that the APA, the American Psychological Association, got involved in the first place was that the health professionals inside the CIA were opposed to what the agency was doing in its post 9/11 enhanced interrogation program. And the APA was brought in a sense, to neutralize those people inside the CIA that were objecting to these methods. So isn't that where the collusion really is or began?
Well, I'm not sure I would. There were objections within the CIA from health professionals. In one case that Mr. Hoffman reports, a psychologist who was a long-term CIA contractor was brought in to argue that that the enhanced interrogations were ethical under APA ethics. And we made arguments in our April report suggesting that there might have been a link between objections within the CIA's Office of Medical Services and the need for the APA to sign on to this being ethical. But I don't want to overstate the rebellions in the CIA. These health professionals may have objected, but they still did it. They were there. They participated in the torture, even when they thought it was wrong. So I just want to make sure that they're not heroes in this. The APA seems to have been brought in to quell various ethical complaints, to make it clear that those who participated in the torture program wouldn't face loss of license or other sanctions in the future.
So, but basically what happened was that the APA's authority and its cachet or whatever was used to justify torture. Is that the bottom line?
Well, not exactly. I mean, they were not interested in torture. Namely, Hoffman shows that they made a strategic calculation not to find out evidence about abuses going on in U.S. government, in detention operations. They weren't exactly supporting torture. What they were doing was supporting the DOD and the CIA, whatever the DOD and CIA were doing. Namely, they were not actively aiding torture. They just weren't paying any attention to it. They were just saying whatever national security psychologists need to do is okay. You know, I know it's a subtle distinction, but it is important in a certain way. And it shows also how disturbing it is. You know, the public knew what was going on, at least those who read the press. Obviously, APA people knew, but they chose to close their eyes to it.
So have you talked to any of the actual people involved, like Ali Sufan with the FBI and Glenn Carl with the CIA, that were among the first to blow the whistle on this torture regime?
I have a number of contacts in the intelligence community, not those two. Friends of mine are in contact with them. But one of the exciting parts of this, or I'm not sure exciting is the right word, but it has been to get to know people in the military and the intelligence agencies who opposed the torture from within, and to realize that a lot of people I would never have gotten to know otherwise, and to get to know them, become friends with them. So there are many who, you know, oppose this, of which those are two potentially, certainly Ali Sufan.
But it leaves you just with this, you know, feeling of why is it that there's never been any culpability? From my understanding is that the professionals weren't listened to, whether they eventually went along with it or not. That at the CIA they got rid of all of the Arabic speaking people. And they brought in people from Latin America, like Rodriguez, who was in charge, which is in itself bizarre. It's as though somebody, you know, somewhere made the decision to get rid of the people who knew anything about interrogation and to bring in these rank amateurs from these two guys from Florida, the Jessup and whatever the other, Mitchell.
Mitchell and Jessen.
Yeah, Jessen, yeah. Is that in broad strokes? Is that what happened? That they just basically were scraping the barrel, looking for somebody to go along with the agenda, as opposed to, you know, listening to people who actually had some experience in interrogation.
Well, I don't think we know exactly what went on in the CIA in those early stages. We're only getting glimpses. The CIA had not been involved in interrogations in recent years, and they seem to have lost their internal knowledge. And so the 9/11 comes, and they're wanting to do this, and somehow some people there knew Mitchell in particular and introduced him around. I think before 9/11, he was already doing some contact work for the CIA. And Mitchell is a very self-assured person. You know, he's one of these, as many consultants are, he gives the feeling that he can do anything. And he conveyed that. I think another issue, sadly, is simply turf battles. The CIA didn't want to turn to the military or the FBI or civilian police for interrogation expertise because they're the CIA. They had to have their own people. And since they didn't have their own people, they had to find them somewhere, and they found them with Mitchell and Jessen.
Well, but it's pretty extraordinary that you could do waterboarding and sleep deprivation, and we don't know because the 92 tapes were destroyed by Rodriguez of what they did. Apparently, those tapes are incredibly incriminating, much more so than what's already on the public record. You know, surely they had to know that this was torture.
Yeah, I mean, clearly they knew that, and that's why they had the Justice Department write memos saying that it wasn't and come up with all kinds of contorted legal rationales. But it's also true that it looks like the decision was made in the White House right after 9/11, and it's that famous interview with Vice President Cheney, what, about a week after 9/11, which he says we're going to have to go to the dark side and do whatever needs to be done. So at some level, the CIA was doing what its masters wanted, which was probably mostly Cheney in the White House.
Well, if Cheney was the master, then the enablers were David Addington and John Yoo. And John Yoo is at the Berkeley Law School. He hasn't suffered at all, as far as I know.
No. Well, he certainly suffered reputation-wise, but yes, he's at Berkeley Law School.
So does this lead? Yeah. Well, it just
he was there, I believe, beforehand. I believe he was already tenured.
Right. Well, but it just leads you go back to that question of will there be justice? It's pretty obvious that Obama made some kind of deal not to go after the Bush administration, and as he said, we're going to look forward, not look backwards. My sense is, since I cover international relations and national security affairs, the price that the U.S. has paid, not just in terms of its moral standing being so tarnished, is that every tin pot dictator around the world, whether it's Mugabe or Saddam or all these people we go after, now have a perfectly good excuse. They say, well, what are the Americans complaining about? You torture too. That seems to me to be really where the U.S. has lost so much of the high ground.
Yeah, and it's not by accident that when ISIS executes Western hostages, they're often in orange jumpsuits. They've just, you know, they've got this ready-made symbolism to use. It was the torture program was a great strategic defeat for the United States, as people like Ali Sufan and Colonel Steve Kleinman pointed out. It's used as a rallying cry for those who oppose the U.S. And will be for many, many years. In terms of accountability, there's an optimistic and a pessimistic side. The optimistic side from Latin America is accountability takes several decades. The pessimistic argument is, however, in Latin America, people tortured citizens in the country, so there was this constituency that was demanding justice. In the United States, we torture foreign Arabs who are never very popular here. So I don't know which one. Will we have accountability like in Latin America after 20 or 30 years, or will we just forget this and someday have, you know, a meaningless apology? I just don't know which way it's going to go.
Well, Dr. Stephen Solz, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Stephen Solz, who's an anti-torture advisor with Physicians for Human Rights, who is the director of the Center for Research, Evaluation, and Program Development at the Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis and the co-founder of the Coalition for an Ethical Psychology. He's one of the two dissident psychologists inside the American Psychological Association who opposed their collaboration with the Bush-Cheney torture regime, which has just been exposed in the scathing Hoffman Report. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back and go to Mexico City to look into the second escape of the drug lord El Chapo Guzman. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Mexico City is Dudley Althaus, who is a correspondent with The Wall Street Journal, who has covered Mexico for the last 27 years. He has covered everything from drug war mayhem to political intrigue to environmental threats and energy industry investment. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dudley Althaus.
Hi, Ian.
And Dudley, I imagine there's quite a buzz going on in Mexico City and Mexico and throughout the country. The second time that the notorious drug lord Joaquin El Chapo Guzman has broken out of a high security prison. Once is pretty bad, but twice is beyond embarrassing.
Yeah, like the expression says, once shame on me. let's try that again.
Yeah.
Once shame on you, twice shame on me.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a major, major deal, and it's a major embarrassment for the Mexican government, which has said that the Mexican president, Enrique Peña Nieto, said last year when Chapo was recaptured that his another escape would be unpardonable and that the government was taking precautions to make sure that wouldn't happen. And here we are.
Well, the fact that they were able to dig a tunnel that's a mile long, that's a major engineering undertaking, isn't it?
It's incredible. You know, one analyst today said that Chapo is the king of tunnels, and I think that's pretty right. When they tried to capture him before his capture last February, the Mexican Marines got very close to him several times, but he always managed to escape through sophisticated tunnels and various safe houses in the Sinaloa state capital of Culiacan that were connected to the tunnel, to the sewer system of the city, and he always managed to get away just moments before the security forces arrived. Then the Sinaloa cartel is also known for building tunnels, drug smuggling tunnels, under the U.S. border in Arizona and California. So these guys have a long experience with very sophisticated tunnels, and obviously this is their masterwork.
So he went into the shower. Have you been able to get a sense of the timeline here of what happened?
Yeah, the government says that he was last seen, the last contact that guards had with him was when they brought him his regular medication at about 8 p.m. There's also vigilance cameras in his cell, and they last saw him shortly before 9 p.m. And he has a separate shower compartment in his cell, which is kind of amazing. But that doesn't have cameras in it, and so he went into the shower and disappeared.
And went through this mile-long tunnel that exited at a construction site a mile away from the prison.
Yeah, the government says the tunnel's almost 10 meters deep, so that's about 30 feet deep. And then he climbed down a ladder and then went through this tunnel that's about 5 feet high and about, you know, 2.5 feet, 3 feet wide that has ventilation systems and lighting and everything else. Chapo, his name means shorty, so he could easily get through a tunnel. But it's just incredible. And if you think about the engineering involved in digging from outside the prison, a mile-long tunnel that comes right up into his very shower stall is pretty incredible. He climbed down a 30-foot ladder and went out the tunnel, and he's gone. Now, there's an international airport 15 miles or less from the prison, and we don't know. They shut down the airport after his escape was discovered, and we don't know what time that was. Obviously, the government has no idea where he is. They have police locking down all kinds of highways and roads and neighborhoods near the prison. But I think, you know, the cat's out of the bag, so to speak.
Well, it's pretty reasonable to assume that this tunnel took a long time to build and that his network on the outside must have very, very good communication with him to let him know what's going on. You know, if not he himself, El Chapo, is micromanaging his own escape, it would be hard to figure that out. But the assumption I would have is that if he could pull together an operation like this, or his lieutenants could pull together an operation like this, they sure as hell have a pretty good escape plan ready as well, wouldn't they?
Well, I would think so, yeah. I mean, one analyst speculated, I think probably the prison escape began from the moment he went into the prison. I had the plans for it. And, I think definitely. And having contacts outside and inside the prison, 18 prison guards and even the warden have been brought in for questioning. And the last time he escaped in 2001, it was an inside job, widely acknowledged even by government officials that it was an inside job. And, it's unthinkable that he could have done this time without some sort of cooperation inside the prison. And what you said, I think, is obviously true. I mean, if you spend all this time digging such an elaborate tunnel, you're not going to get caught, like, running down the highway near the prison. He's gone.
And again, we're speaking with Dudley Althaus in Mexico City, where he's a correspondent for The Wall Street Journal who has covered Mexico for the last 27 years. And the last time he escaped, of course, was in 2001. We were hid in a laundry basket, but that also involved bribing prison officials. And I guess that gets to the heart of the problem, doesn't it? You know, the choice you have in law enforcement in Mexico is silver or lead, right? You take a bullet or take a bribe. And
Well, I mean, that's I think absolutely right. I mean, and either one is a very effective strategy for the part of these drug lords. This prison, by the way, holds many of Mexico's top, criminal lords and top criminals. If Chapo has the most, probably the most money and the most resources, and definitely obviously has the best engineers that could pull off something like this. But it makes you wonder about the rest of them, just how secure Mexico's prisons are. You know, the Mexican government, Mexican officials said at the time he was captured that they would consider extradition after Chapo served his prison time in Mexico, which, if he were convicted, would have added up to hundreds of years. So it was basically, they said, yes, you're open to extradition, but effectively it wasn't going to happen, that he was going to face Mexican justice rather than U.S. justice. How Washington responds to this escape is going to be interesting to see.
Well, I think Forbes had him on their billionaires list, didn't they?
Yes, they did. Famously, they was on the billionaires list. And, you know, I mean, there's been some question about how they figure that up, but Chapo definitely was a very wealthy man. This is a man with a third-grade education, born to a very poor family in the mountains of Sinaloa on the Pacific coast, who came up by his own wiles and probably his own inclination for violence, muscling out other rivals within the Sinaloa cartel and then, rivals in other drug gangs. He's usually portrayed in Mexico as more of a kinder, gentler sort of gangster. He himself would put up banners in towns where he was trying to move in and take over, that he was not interested in, preying on the local population with extortion, kidnapping, and the rest, that he was a drug trafficker and he was going to protect the local towns that he came into from other more violent and more predatory drug gangs. But it's often forgotten that really Mexico's decade of hyperviolence that we've had here since 2004, 2005, really began with Chapo Guzman moving in on rivals' drug trafficking corridors into the United States along the Texas border. And, his efforts to take over Ciudad Juarez in 2008 basically unleashed a 3 or 4 year drug war in that city that made it the most dangerous city in the world and probably claimed about 10,000 lives over the course of 3 or 4 years.
And you mentioned Peña Nieto earlier. Obviously he's embarrassed by this. When he said this earlier, did he say that it wasn't going to happen, he wasn't going to break out again, or that they were going to make sure he didn't break out again? What kind of promises did he make?
Well, he said, yes, they were taking, obviously, he said, obviously, clearly we're taking the precautions that we're going to make that happen. Uh-huh. He said that, the direct quote, and it's being replayed on Mexican television today, that interview, and which is just kind of like really going to be embarrassing for the government. He said, more than lamentable, another escape would be unforgivable. Hmm. And he said, the escape that happened years ago will never again occur. And they're replaying that today on national television here. So this is obviously a major embarrassment for the president. He, in fact, just landed in Paris today. He took a delegation of 440 people to Paris with him for a state visit, and they just landed. The interior minister, who's in charge of public security, is rushing back to Mexico right now. We haven't heard from Mr. Peña Nieto yet today, but obviously this is a major, major blow to their image.
But why do you need 440 people to go to France? Well, what was the purpose?
He's been certainly criticized for that.
What was the ostensible purpose for this trip to France?
Well, I mean, it's a state visit, but supposedly they're buying weapons for the security forces and other things. But, it's a state visit. But he was criticized earlier this year for taking a huge delegation to London for a visit, which included, state dinners with the Queen and everything else.
So has he recovered from the earlier scandal with his wife and the property from the crony that gave them such generous
terms? Well, it's been toned down, but he hasn't fully recovered from that. No, I mean, he's had a very bad year. He's had a very bad year, and it's, he was riding high, and then the corruption scandals and the massacres of, the massacre of 43 teachers, college students, ostensibly at the hands of drug gangsters in league with local police south of Mexico City. And the government's response to that had hurt him last September, and then the corruption scandals involving his wife's mansion in Mexico City's most upscale neighborhood that was paid for or is being bought on terms from a government contractor. A number of scandals have hurt him in the past 10 months, and this certainly doesn't help anything.
But the disappearance and murder of the Teachers College students in Guerrero, surely that also affects the PRD, because the crooked mayor was a PRD mayor. So just as much as the PRI is hurt by its handling of the student disappearance, surely the PRD is also impacted by it.
Well, that's right. I mean, the PRD got really hurt by that as well. I mean, the PRD, we just had midterm congressional and some local elections, some state elections here in Mexico in June, and the PRD was walloped. One of their major, the man who was the PRD's presidential candidate in 2012 and in 2006, has left the party and began his own party, which, took about half the PRD's vote. But what the midterm election showed was that all the major political parties, the National Action Party, which is conservative, the PRI, which is more middle of the road, and the PRD, which is of the left, all of them have been hurt. They all went into league together to pass congressional reforms, dramatic congressional reforms for, privatizing the oil industry after 78 years, and other measures that were widely praised as historic by outside analysts and many inside Mexico, has pretty much put all the major parties into the same box, and they've all been, their prestige of all of them has been badly hurt in the past year, and the midterm election showed that.
So in terms of the fatigue that the Mexican people have towards this drug war, which has cost over 100,000 lives, it's led to vigilante groups taking over the defense of towns. In terms of the promises that Peña Nieto made, that he could do it better than his predecessor, who many blamed for the violence or for his handling of the situation in terms of this prosecuting this war on drugs with the U.S. Clearly, Peña Nieto's, whatever his strategy was, it was never very clear to me, it's not working.
Well, I mean, it's working in the sense of taking down a number of drug lords, including Chapo Guzman, who, is now free again, but they've taken down a number of drug lords, but as long as the trafficking continues, I mean, there's a plethora, if you will, of drug gangs now that are just as violent as the other ones. And in some senses, they've lost control where a major drug lord, a guy as smart as Chapo Guzman, might want to moderate violence. These other gangs are smaller gangs with younger kids, teenagers and men in their young early 20s for the most part. Are really less in control. The government, when Peña Nieto came in, he criticized his predecessor, Felipe Calderón, for using blunt force against the drug gangs with the Army and the Marines and the federal police in the streets and confronting these guys in open combat. They said they were going to do it more with, using intelligence, using, investigations more and targeting drug lords. And they've done that to some extent. What they've not been able to do is really stamp out the violence, at least in a lot of the parts of the country. And just recently, we had the federal police attacking a ranch outside Guadalajara, near Guadalajara in western Mexico, and killing 42 suspected gangland gunmen and losing only one police officer, which really led people to speculate that it was more of a massacre than a police raid, that they went in with the intention of not taking any prisoners. So they've kind of reverted back to blunt force again, and we'll see where this heads. It's not good. Things have not really been resolved. There's still a lot of drug trafficking through here, and obviously, and the gangs are still very well armed and very dangerous.
And was there much publicity in Mexico about the tragic incident in San Francisco with a Mexican national who'd been deported 5 times, who shot a young woman out for a stroll at a tourist spot in San Francisco with her father?
Well, it's been covered here, but not as much as, say, police shootings of Mexican nationals in the United States, which have happened occasionally, and in one case just in Washington. The Mexican press tends to focus more on, you know, sort of the fate of Mexican nationals being shot or otherwise abused by Mexican U.S. security forces than that. But that certainly has been covered here.
And what about Donald Trump?
The San Francisco case has been covered here.
Right. But what about Donald Trump? Is he getting
Donald Trump is all over the news here.
Really?
people are as outraged as many people in the United States are, probably more so here in Mexico. People are always very attuned to slights from the United States. And so, yeah, that has definitely been covered here in Mexico.
Well, but surely they must see the connection that the more outrageous and racist, insulting Trump's comments are towards Mexicans or Mexican immigrants here in the United States, the higher he goes up in the polls with Republican primary voters.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And this certainly is not going to help Mexico's image and will help Trump's argument in the United States, I think, as far as Mexico being out of control and unable to handle its security situation and that sort of thing. I think definitely this will throw fuel into that fire.
Well, Dudley Altatz, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And we've been speaking with Dudley Althaus in Mexico City, where he's the Wall Street Journal correspondent who has covered Mexico for the last 27 years. He has covered everything from drug war mayhem and political intrigue to environmental threats and energy industry investment.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.